Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow, July 14th, is Bastille Day, Liberty, Equality, Fraternity. Bastille Day is French Independence Day and is generally regarded as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789. The hated symbol of kings and arbitrary rule, the French rebels were determined to attack and destroy the Bastille prison. They were joined by the Garde Française, which had been sent to stop them. When the Bastille defenders refused to surrender, the mob stormed the prison and destroyed it. That the Bastille was attacked with an enthusiasm of heroism such as only the highest animation of liberty could inspire, wrote Thomas Paine in The Rights of Man, as it is not difficult to perceive from the enlightened state of mankind, the hereditary governments are verging to their decline, and that revolutions are on the broad basis of national sovereignty and government by representation are making their way in Europe, it would be an act of wisdom to anticipate their approach and produce revolution by reason and accommodation, rather than commit them to the issue of convulsions. From what we now see, nothing of reform in the political world ought to be held improbable. It is an age of revolutions in which everything may be looked for. And that's Paine. If the 18th century was the age of enlightenment and of revolution, the 21st century seems rapidly to become an age of dictators and autocrats, which was foreshadowed by the examples of Nazism and fascism in the 1930s and 1940s, and presciently envisioned by late 20th century writers who saw Soviet-style communism as the model and harbinger of status techno-despotism in which the individual human being is reduced to an insignificant cybernized cipher shorn of human rights. The French Revolution ended with the guillotine and Napoleon. For us, it has been the rise of Trump, who is the caricature of our enduring racism, xenophobia, and laissez-faire fascism, integrated with an overweening sense of omnipotence. It seems more than ever probable, given the ramped-up revelations, that the entire Trump campaign for president was a Rasputin idea, which was the name of a Russian mad monk who proved very hard to kill. Vladimir Putin would rather be compared to Tsars Peter and Ivan, one renowned, the other reviled. Putin picked the man most likely to propel the USA into history's dung heap. It would appear that the hoggish narcissist has been played for a fool by his Olympian hero. As William Buckley is reported to have said of Trump's self-worship, when he looks into a glass, he is mesmerized by its reflection. A friend of Voltaire said there would never be justice, equality, or liberty in the world until the last king was strangled with the intestines of the last priest. And now, I would like to read something that I wrote. Summers of Love and War. You cannot have change without the young. The young have the creativity, they have the energy, they have the impatience. You need the youth to dissent. And that's by Abby Hoffman. And by Grace Slick, remember what the Dormouse said, keep your head. All sorts of people clogging America's retirement system are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the Summer of Love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly pampered and upper-class white flower children, briefly abandoned social strictures and sang, danced, and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors who have done in the primeval veldt before civilization and Christianity dampened our freewheeling pagan spirits. Mecca that legendary summer 50 years ago was San Francisco, Baghdad by the Bay, historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quicksilver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms. A song that summer urged westward bound emigres, if you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair. an ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking. Food, lodging, medical care, sex, and wine. Even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace, and love. It all went badly quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and faraway summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggles of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week. And God, Buddha alone, knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture that grew from the summer of love, simultaneous with its final fling of Woodstock, produced its most infamous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s are set apart from other decades. They are different not so much for their intensity. The World War II years of the 1940s were far more intense. Or because they were more flamboyant and colorful. The jazz age of the 1920s had more flash, or for that matter, because they were fueled by division and insurrection. The 1770s and 1860s make better claims. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or perhaps more aptly, with a single immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil insurrection movement of mainly disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction and the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the war came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, in particular pilots, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism. A new left replaced the old left, and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled gypsy law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few are inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the young once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the summer, the 1967 summer of love and flower power, was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations, generally set off by police and National Guards armed with clubs, guns, and gas. The 1968 presidential campaign, which pitted Democrats Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy against the war as well as against each other, failed to change anything. Republican Richard Nixon was elected most likely as a result of Kennedy's assassination minutes after he won the California Democratic primary. Nixon despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever, 2 years later culminating in the shooting deaths of 4 white students at Kent State by the Ohio National Guard, and at least 2 blacks, both women, shot by police at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution, the Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts, and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968 was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked. Not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games, and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are generally saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made among the internationalists other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak. The Winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe Sanh, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war, the devastation of the ancient imperial city of Wei, and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life, organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, would have probably been elected if he had not been murdered in June. In August 1968, a peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although culturists claimed the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire the later anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion, and added hardened, disaffected veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. Veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, though many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were 2 mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited a far and exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately defused the rebellion. Draft-age males, assured of avoiding combat service, lost interest in the immorality of the war and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy, driven by hopeful or grim visions. The New Left dissipated into a pabulum of New Age kitsch. There were always contradictions among the countercultures of the 1960s. Hip culture chasing a buck in contrast to politicized hippies who wanted to abolish wealth. Nirvana seeking acid heads versus hardcore speed freaks and junkies. But everybody was against and in fear of the cops. The flower power dream of transcending materialism with goodwill failed, but not before it seeded the environmental movement and made ideas about pacifism, justice, and equality respectable. The most far-reaching legacy of the inspired and self-indulgent 1960s is the women's movement. The lingering problem, however, is that the fun-seeking nation adopted the sex, drug, and party habits of the young boomers, but not the philosophies or politics. Young Ben Braddock is portrayed by Dustin Hoffman in the film version of The Graduate, written by Charles Webb, spoke for a disillusioned generation of baby boomers in early maturity when he said, "I don't know what I am, Dad, and I don't particularly care." Later, that spiritual emptiness would gorge on frenzied materialism, but for a short period, a large number of primarily affluent young Americans attempted to combat cultural nihilism with experiments towards a moral republic which was to be lightly governed for the benefit of all persons by intelligent goodwill. Some among the large restless tribe that worshipped the image of eternal youth never got much older, swept up in the war that everyone seemed powerless to stop. A few endured jail to avoid the war or sought exile in other countries. Others resisted the war and defiantly braved guns, clubs, and disabling chemicals of police and National Guardsmen, many of whom enlisted in state militias to avoid service in the war. The drugs that originally opened the minds of thousands of alienated children seared them to ash in subsequent years. Although the baby boom generation temporarily repudiated the corrupt leadership and incessant greed of the nation, rapidly germinating and degenerating, dizzily heady ideologies and social solutions, it grew increasingly fond of the riches it had previously loathed. Most softened their resistance to the 7-Eleven values of their culture as they grew older. Communal patterns and politics were abandoned. Business networking among the former rebels replaced communalism. The happy, acquisitive, workaholic, well-dined yuppie metamorphed from the angst-riven flower child hippie who thought universal love and open sex would make the world a better place. Yuppies contortedly justified their pursuit of wealth and status as compatible with their lingering sympathies for social justice. Now the baby boomers who made so much trouble to their families and their country while they were growing up are older than their parents a generation ago. The war that traumatized their vulnerable youth is long past, although its residue continues to disturb amnesia. The psychopathic Cold War they grew up with ended abruptly with the collapse and disintegration of the Russian Communist Empire. The summer of love was the generation's iridescent mirage, the watershed of its vanished youth. They were born after World War II, and their memories don't include the daily sounds of bombers and bombs that tormented and killed children all over the world a few years earlier. Yet their continuing angst is a legacy of their parents' war. They were born under the sign of the mushroom cloud. The baby boomers grew up with the baby bomb. More than their rebellion against prosperity and its flaccid corruption of spirit, their dread of nuclear holocaust defined their passionate protest against the Vietnam War. More even than personal fears of young males, they would be drafted into it. This first nuclear generation, also the first TV generation, felt a shared stake in the future, and apart from hype and herd instinct, they tried to be kind to each other. They are so large a generation, they crash through history as irresistibly as fire, remaking everything they sweep past. They are so accustomed to the attention of society, even now in their millennial twilight, they believe they are the force of history itself. And that was Summers of Love and War, which I wrote. And now something else I wrote, Children of Darkness, with a quote by Ursula Le Guin, "Bigots have small ears." 75 years ago last Thursday, on July 6, 1942, which was a Monday that year, Anne Frank and her family fled into hiding from the Nazis who occupied Holland and were persecuting Jews. They stayed in hiding in Amsterdam for 2 years until betrayed to the Nazis and sent to death camps in Poland. Anne's father, Otto Frank, was the only survivor at the end of World War II. He had been separated from his wife and two daughters at Auschwitz. Anne and her sister Margot died of typhus at Bergen-Belsen detention camp, essentially from abandoned overcrowding, starvation, and medical neglect, only weeks from Allied rescue. Repatriated to Amsterdam, Otto Frank was given a diary his daughter Anne kept during the period of hiding, which had been saved by Dutch friends who had aided them. Their betrayer was never identified. The Diary of Anne Frank, which was first published by her father in 1947, has sold nearly 50 million copies in more than 60 languages. With the exception of the Christian Bible, it is the most widely read nonfiction book in the world. How many Anne Franks might be writing diaries at this moment in the United States while hiding from federal immigrant agents, the ICE men cometh, hoping to not be found and kept prisoner in private profit gulags before being sent back and perhaps murdered or brutally enslaved to the countries they fled in terror. Underneath the Daily News, which is under assault by Donald Trump, is the underreported story that Trump and his ICE Gestapo are disfiguring America into a gulag state of imprisoned migrants and refugees awaiting mass deportations. The nightmarish possibility of Nazi-like detention camps for dissident American citizens, in addition to Muslim and Latin American immigrants and refugees by Trump's insurgent coup d'etat of government, is enhanced by the Attorney General's reversal of former President Obama's attempts to phase out private prisons. The private prison industry is rapidly expanding with the locking up of immigrants, imitating the ugly precedent of the internment of Japanese Americans 75 years ago when FDR signed Executive Order 9066 in 1942 during World War II, the same year Anne Frank and her family went into hiding. Two-thirds of the Japanese incarcerated were American citizens. The private prison industry might serve as the new concentration camps and reflect the intensified bigotry, misogyny, and xenophobia unleashed by Trump's presidency. It should be noted that the first internment camps in this country are called Indian reservations. Private for-profit prisons are tantamount to subsidized slavery. Civil punishment and incarceration is a public matter for which society must bear a direct responsibility for every person it locks behind bars, whether citizen, immigrant, or refugee. Public punishment should not be contracted out privately. Call it the Cool Hand Luke syndrome. Years, perhaps even lifetimes of hard labor for small-time busts, paid nothing and stripped of all constitutional rights. How else do you define slavery or inquisition? The private prison industry, like all commercial pursuits, is dedicated to profit rather than public responsibility. The more prisoners, the more money funded by government. Vulture capitalism at its most predatory outside of war. Excessively cruel acts as turning law enforcement against immigrants and refugees, whether documented or not, as Hitler did to Jews and Trump to Muslims and Hispanics, truly endangers the constitutional security of the United States by militarizing the police and giving police powers to the military. This purgatorial period of sanctioned intolerance by a right-wing nationalist presidential administration and its rabidly totalitarian and racist policies will quite likely be recorded in our future history as a moral monstrosity, a denial of decency and humanity equal to black slavery and the genocide of native tribes. As a nation, the United States has meddled and mostly corrupted Latin American governments for its own ends, and yes, intruded in elections, most notoriously in Chile, in which a popularly elected president was murdered in a U.S. CIA-backed coup that installed a military dictatorship on 9/11/1973. The list of abuses in the Southern Hemisphere, which we treat as though it were our own plantation, is long and shameful. Refugees who have fled the brutal, dysfunctional tyrannies we have puppetried in their countries are too often denied asylum in the United States, paradoxically the only place they seem to believe they might be safe. It is especially ironic that children from these countries are recruited into migrant drug cartels in American cities, similar to those their families escaped. expulsion of thousands of juvenile gang members who grew up in American ghettos has boomeranged into a flood of younger generations of refugees escaping violence and virtual slavery incited by deportee gangs who savagely supply America's national opiate obsession. It presents a macabre circle. Impoverished families flee their homelands because of Yankee colonial-style policies, often CIA incursion as well, that tyrannize them, forced to slip through our borders under the radar, and if not caught, imprisoned, and evicted, their children are frequently absorbed into street gangs, jailed and deported, and recruited into vicious drug gangs back home to terrorize and murder even younger children who flee to the USA. Echoes reverberate of the infamous Children's Crusade, led to slaughter by prelate pipers in medieval times. This new children's exodus has spawned an anti-immigrant inquisition of shrieking intolerables who insist these hapless innocents be forcibly returned to the appalling horridness of the homelands they fled. Americans think of themselves as communities of generosity, hospitality, and charity. We are witnessing the ugliness migrants provoke in some of our fellow citizens. Yet the core of our national mythos is that our ancestors arrived here fleeing persecution. The malignantly racist anti-immigrant Trump presidency is a test of us as a nation and as a people. We have an opportunity for atonement, a chance to make right what we have made wrong. We must resist, revolt against, and reform the hateful, absurd regression inflicted by neo-atavistic totalitarians who are rapidly dismantling constitutional democracy. Abraham Lincoln said about the blood-stained efforts to abolish slavery in the USA, "We cannot escape history. The fiery trail through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation." And that was Children of Darkness. And now a poem, Summer's Children. We do not know who chose us, but we are the chosen. We were chosen not to be you. We enter your cities like fog, with our bedrolls and our portable lives, our ragged coats always too big, the better for sleeping in. We follow summer, and we all look alike to you, with our uncombed hair. We look like winter. When we are young, we look older. When we are older, we begin to look young. You do not want to look at us. And since we are invisible to you, we can urinate anywhere. We are not lost. We know where we are. But our itinerary is chance and weather. We do not believe in destinations, and we are in no hurry. We have learned patience from statues in 1,000 parks and joy from dogs without collars. We envy you nothing you want. We can live on what you throw away. We envy only birds of passage, their ability to fly. Sometimes we ask for your spare change, but never your credit cards. Otherwise, we keep our distance, avoiding the germs of your misery. The wolf does not come to our doors. We have no doors. We have lost our names somewhere and are required to sign nothing. We do not pay taxes. We feed the birds. We do not vote. Why should we vote for you? We do not join the army. We are an army, and we will not fight in your wars. We have lost our return addresses, our forwarding addresses, our social security numbers, and are secure in our own society. We leave messages to one another on the undersides of bridges in a code you cannot decipher. But we plot to overthrow nothing. We escape. We are summer's children, born into your winter. We are not a problem. We are a solution to a problem. You are the problem. And that was Summer's Children by Richard Shelton. And before I close, two sympathetic friends heard a sorrowful note crawl through my throat at the end of a recent program. It was probably the equivalent of a sigh that usually accompanies flashes of Astoria across my synapses, which occurs frequently even after 2.5 years away. Then I feel remorse that I am separated from the continuing lives of my friends, whom I miss greatly. This has been Michael McCusker.